tonight, it's my privilege to introduce our next two speakers, Professor John Wood and Professor Barry Billingsley, who are not currently in my line of sight. I'll assume they're in the room. Oh, there you are. Excellent. Good. Well done. So John Wood was a metallurgist, is one of those people I'm very grateful seems to have an inability to say no to doing jobs in universities. He's been on many committees and many advisory bodies and trustees of things. And you can read all about those in his biography. And also, we're very grateful that he's the chair of trustees of Christians in Science. Barry Billingsley is a professor of science and education at Canterbury Christ Church University, and also leads the Learning About Science and Religion project there. Barry started her career with the BBC and so has beautifully integrated her academic and communication skills in reaching a lot of children at the moment. Again, you can see the details on her bio, and she's also brought some leaflets which are on the registration table. So I'm going to hand over to John and to Barry now.
Okay, thanks. Well, welcome one and all. This is very much an experiment, and after the last talk, I feel quite humble and just throw it at you, because Barry arrived at lunchtime and we haven't been able to collaborate until then, so let's see what happens. It's very much like a sandwich. I'm the bit of bread, and then we get the meat or the vegetarian dish in the middle. I haven't thought of a new analogy for that yet, which Barry will give, and then I will follow up at the end with some thoughts. This is an incredibly long title. That's what happens when you have two people who haven't collaborated too well together to put it together. But I think there are some key themes here that run on from much of today's talk about conservation, about our responsibility to the society, but also about humility and looking at what truth really is. Because, I put this up because I thought this mural at the back looked rather like the compact muon solenoid at CERN. And I was there on Wednesday with the Bishop of St. Albans as part of the Take Your Vicar to the Lab scheme at the St. Albans. He actually found himself inspired by this. Anthony Harris, who's here, was also with me, as well as a lot of others. So this thing here, it's even got the tracking on. How amazing. Well, let's get on with the real talk. Albert Einstein said a lot of things, but I think this is one of the things I really do resonate with, that imagination is more important than knowledge. And he's saying knowledge is just getting the facts, as it were, looking at what's there, what we see with our own little eyes, but having imagination takes in the whole world, the whole universe, and the wonder of all of God's creation, in my opinion. Now, one of the things I'm really worried about is the trust that we have in what scientists say. It was on the news today, actually, about the fracking, and the, Ledson, was saying, science says, I thought, well, who is this person called science who says all these things? Okay, we've got certain facts that come out from the scientific inquiry, but who is it that says, who is science? And I picked up this from the Times a few weeks ago. It's about psychologists, but we're in trouble if we can't trust scientists. So what do scientists say? Well, here's one thing they say. Science says drinking coffee helps people slow aging, lose weight, and cheat death. It's much better than what Keith was talking about, all the genetic modifications. You just have to drink coffee, apparently. And this person, science, says it. So it must be true. And so it's now time to start. So I don't know if there's any still out there. So I started worrying about where we were coming from when we have these dogmatic statements, which actually have very little behind them and sometimes are entirely wrong. And I came across this quote by the author of The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. The laws of probability, so true in general, so false in particular. That what we often think of as truth is only a partial truth, is only a partial truth from our perspective. And this is very much distorted by the media. I did this slide before the general election was announced. Okay, and we know about the role of the media in distorting concept that people say about science, and actually bringing about a distrust in what science says as well. We all know this particular activity that went on and still is going on. I was hearing today about certain homeopathic, I don't know if you call them doctors, but whatever they are, practitioners, feeding more and more into this, that it's dangerous to have your child vaccinated against MMR. So who do we trust? Well, this was from 2017. You won't be able to read this. The persons that we most trust are nurses, apparently. And would you believe, right at the bottom, the ones we least trust are politicians? I think we could have got that right. But look down, if you can see it, the fourth down, we have teachers here, they're third down. They do better than a lot of us. But fourth down are professors, and fifth down are scientists. So I should average between the two. I think it's at 84.5 or something. So we're right up at the top. But why do people trust us? Yeah. Why do people trust us? So right at the bottom, we have politicians, we have bankers slightly near the bottom, and in the middle, we have clergy. So who do we trust? The bank, the clergy, or the scientists? Okay, according to popular opinion, we trust the scientists above all. But are we telling the truth? Now, for me as a Christian, the truth is not about facts and things I can measure. For me, the truth is about something personal and relationship. Relational is about our personal and relationships with the Lord Jesus Christ. If you abide in my word and you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. This whole word abiding in the truth, I think it needs to be explored. I leave it to the theologians. This was a book by Ben Quash a few years ago, looking at abiding. And I come back to then, what does that mean for us as scientists? On what basis is science truthful? Do we barter our profession by chasing money for the sake of the next grant, for those in industry or in academia for promotion, for investment or in sales? What is it that we are actually pursuing? Do we see from our own disciplines the wider truth of where we're operating in? So I think Christian scientists specifically are encouraged, and it goes back to the talks we've already had, to look at the really big picture about where we are in this world and what our calling is. And I do believe being a scientist is a Christian calling. I hope you believe that too. It's something that's taken me many, many years to accept, but I do believe it to be true. Well, I go back to Michael Faraday. Nothing is too wonderful to be true if it is consistent with the laws of nature. That's pretty profound. And I won't go into the rest of it, but I will take up this last one because I'm going to come back to poetry again, because I do think poetry in many senses emphasizes the holistic approach to what we're talking about. And he says, I am no poet, but if you think it for yourselves as I proceed, the facts will form a poem in your minds, a holistic approach. Now, one of my colleagues at CERN, I'm a consultant there, not on particle physics, I should say, sent me this about the history of physics, which I think sums up physics pretty quickly. Sorry about this, Paul. I know you're and there are other physicists. Aristotle said a bunch of stuff that was wrong. Galileo and Newton fixed things up. Then Einstein broke everything again. Now we've basically got it all worked out, except for small stuff, big stuff, hot stuff, cold stuff, fast stuff, heavy stuff, dark stuff, turbulence, and the concept of time. I hope that sums up. Rhoda, you can correct me if that's not right. I like this. And I came intrigued by reading, first of all, Carlo Rossetti. I wonder what's his name now. Ravelli's book about time. Because I thought to myself, well, I thought I'd got light and time and other things sorted out in my mind. And he says in this book that we need to rebel against the deepest roots of science. Rebellion is among the deepest roots of science, the refusal to accept things as they are at the moment. And here we're back to poetry again. Perhaps poetry is another of science's deepest roots, the capacity to see beyond the visible, to see the whole picture, the whole picture. And I was always brought up on entropy increases, and therefore time goes forward. No, I'm simple. Although I am a bit of a thermodynamicist, or I was. Now, what he says in this book, I think it's called The Origins of Time, I can't quite read it from here, quantized time, the Planck length of does time exist at this point? And I love this phrase, time is ignorance. Time is ignorance. And one of the things I learned working in Africa over the last few years, I was waiting for a taxi, and I was getting irritated because the taxi hadn't arrived, and I was looking at the clock, and my African friend to me said, John, I want to share something with you. We have a sort of saying in Africa, the Westerners have watches, but Africans have time. Okay, and I think we need to take that seriously because we're bound up in Kronos time and we forget about Kairos time. And I'd like to explore that again another time, except I don't have time. It's an old one, isn't it? One of the people I love to quote is Richard Feynman. I wish I'd met him, but I've watched a lot of his lectures and things on video. I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than have answers which might be wrong. But this is the one I want you to take forward. If you thought that science was certain, well, that's just an error on your part. And I like to talk to non-scientists about that because they think that we deal with certainties, absolute certainties. We deal with partial certainties, but not absolute ones. And he gives it in the book, Quantum Electrodynamics, this quote about, well, it's not a quote so much, he's giving a lecture to some a general audience. He said, you're not going to understand a word I'm going to talk about light, so why am I going to bother you with it? Well, just stick with me, because my students don't understand it, anything about light, because I don't understand it, and that's because no one does. And I was a bit worried because Andrew's here from the Diamond Light Source, who we used to work together, and he knows much more about light than I do, and I think Paul does as well. But I just like this thing that actually there are some areas where we don't know, but we do use light. We do use light. And I'm a sort of somebody who uses light a lot. It illuminates, it burns, it transforms, it communicates, it manipulates, it accelerates, it interrogates. But I don't understand it, but I still use it. So maybe this gets over this picture of we can understand a little bit, but we don't understand fully. I didn't go to this lecture, but I picked it up from the Darwin lecture series earlier this year by Professor Peter Fletcher, who's, as I understand it, a surgeon, I think. Anyway, you may know. And he's talking about the visual system in its structure and function confers a ready tendency to create perceptions, to see visions. And he has a number of ideas in that lecture. To perceive is ultimately an act of inference, a multi-stage process concocted of two key ingredients, expectation and input. This entails a powerful but perilous ways of seeing our world. And I learned this myself when I was a postdoc at the time working on a particular material. It was a complicated intermetallic, and my background was transmission electron microscopy and diffraction, and I've been working on vacancy atomic clusters, and that's all I saw in this material after I'd processed it. My friend from Adelaide University took my samples away. He was an expert on another type of defect, and he only saw what he was interested in. We had actually blocked out, because our expectations of what we were going to see were part of us, and we'd actually ignored other things. Very, very big lesson for me at the time. How do you balance all this lot together? Well, there's another quote from a book, it's a science fiction book, actually, which Brian Aldiss wrote with Roger Penrose as an advisor. And I think it is important, too, and he talks about the fact it's a mark of a creative person that they can hold opposite ideas in tension without trying to resolve them. Now, you know it's true, and that's why I've got the bow and arrow down there, because when you have a bow and arrow, where's the tension? It's out sideways and inwards into the string. Which way does the arrow go? Okay, it goes orthogonally to the tension. And its ability to hold these things in tension before you can get real creativity. So it's a tension of opposites. Again, Richard Feynman said, religion is a culture of faith, science is a culture of doubt. I turned it round and said, sometimes science is a culture of faith, and sometimes religion is a culture of doubt. Honest doubt has a role in both. Is there an embracing theology of doubt that can assist science? I pose that as a question. And one of the issues that comes up is that we have a, we have a keyhole theology, and we often have a keyhole science. We look at things through a very narrow perspective, and we know about what we can't see in the universe. And one of the things I think is worse, and we alluded it to this morning, the first talk, was that the concept of science as we know it now is a very recent development. I use the word Wissenschaft, which means scholarship, which is slightly wider. But until really the end of the 19th century, this whole concept of specialization was not prevalent. So there was a trouble in my mind between key theology, keyhole theology, as I call it, and keyhole science. This is from a book by Os Guinness, who was at my school, actually. But in his book, Doubt, Faith in Two Minds, you don't see enough to come to a conclusion, but once you see a little, it's difficult to resist trying. Being insistent as well as inquisitive, we refuse to suspend judgment, and our wrong conclusions so misrepresent God that we end up doubting. You may want to comment on that. One of my colleagues at Nottingham University when I was Dean of Engineering there was Tony Thistleton, the theologian, and he... and I do commend this book to you, Doubt, Faith, and Certainty. He's been talking to John Polkinghorne about the whole area of uncertainty and things. And he writes in this book, doubt and questioning may open the door to new insights. This is attention again. And a need to reappraisal of faith or belief. Some who claim for themselves absence of doubt and possession of utter certainty may possibly be masking a degree of arrogance behind a display of piety. The biblical narratives anticipate partial certainty, which is to be vindicated in the future. And from Paul's letter to Corinthians, for now we see in the mirror dimly, but then we shall see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know fully, even as I am fully known. I do commend that book to you. Challenging the truth has always been the mark of real progress in science. Just give two examples here. I think we all know Jocelyn Bell-Benner and the discovery of pulsars, where Tony Hewish, her supervisor, said that's nonsense. He got the Nobel Prize and she got nothing. She questioned what was going on and persisted. The one at the bottom, I remember seeing this diffraction pattern. I think it was 1973. In a journal in my department, and a colleague of mine who's working on a similar system to this, this is Dan Scheckman, by the way, and of course you know, the first, if you know anything about electron diffraction, in the old days we were told that twofold symmetry, threefold symmetry, fourfold symmetry was permitted, but not fivefold symmetry, it didn't cost. That's fivefold symmetry. And Dan showed that you could actually get materials with fivefold symmetry. And later on, Roger Penrose, the mathematician I've always quoted, showed that you could fill space this way. But those are two people who questioned and were thought initially to be off the block. I remember sitting down with my friend, because he had similar samples to this. We rushed down, I did the electron microscopy, and we saw that it was true. But I blocked it all out beforehand, because I was taught that it was wrong. It's an old problem. Plato knew about it. Strange times are these in which we live, when old and young are taught falsehoods in school. Sorry about the school teachers here. And the person that dares to tell the truth is called at once a lunatic and a fool. At this point, I'm going to hand over to the meat or vegetarian filling to Berry.
Well, I don't know which is more exciting, co-presenting with John or talking to everybody here. John has come to a couple of our events now for schools, and some other people here have as well. And when I introduce myself, so I'm Professor Berry Billingsley, and I'm at Canterbury Christ Church University, and you may have heard I lead LASAR, which is Learning About Science and Religion. So you can see there's a schools and education connection there. I always say, I'm the lucky one in a way, because I look to the boffins, and I'm sorry I call lots of people who are in this room boffins when I'm talking to children, but I look to the boffins to help me to think about some of these big questions and some interesting ways to relate science and religion. And I think the work that is there for people like me to then draw on is so powerful. And one of the things that's brilliant about my role, especially when we've got funding, is that young people are not in contact with those ways of thinking. And I can show you a considerable weight of research to evidence that, having been working in this area now for quite a long time, hence going slightly grey and overtired in the eyes. But the lack for young people of coming into contact with ways of relating science and religion, other than as simple stereotypes, is, as I say, something that I think we can all do. And picking up on this theme that that John introduced, I'm going to play with a word. I did say to you that I really enjoy this phrase. So John introduced me to this phrase, sufficient truth. And I like that a lot. I think that's a really helpful bit of language, which is an example of what's currently missing in schools, sufficient truth. Because you don't really get that in schools. Do you? You've got the right answer, or you've got the wrong answer, or you've got an opinion, haven't you? In fact, when I talk to young people about how do they relate science and religion, well, you go to science and they tell you facts, and you go to RE, or you go to religion classes, depending on what they want to call it, and you're allowed opinions. And that's the difference between them. You can have opinions over there, down in that classroom, and over here, that teacher's not much interested in your opinions. And sometimes they will let you have a bit of a discussion, but really it's just to humour you, and then they'll tell you what the right answer is. Now then you might think, well, all right, let's try and change that then. Let's change how that works in the classroom. So I'm going to take you back to one of my first experiences. I'm all fired up. I've been to lots of conferences like this. I've heard lots of people talking. Gone to the Faraday Institute and been on the summer course. This is quite some time back now. Rushed back into my classroom, full of energy. Say to the young people, these are 15, 16-year-olds, I say, it's really exciting. Science is changing all the time. New ideas are coming up. You might be the next scientist, and you might be changing everything that's here. Anyway, four students, big lads there, are increasingly looking like thunder. They are so angry that after a while, I can't continue. So I say, well, what's wrong? You know, why are you not excited? This was meant to get you all fired up and excited. What you're telling us then, miss, is we've just wasted 4 years. So in other words, if those science classrooms were not giving them, as you said, absolute truth, facts, well then, what were they there for? Because that's what the young people think they are going to science for, facts and proof and experiments that will give them the right answer. And that, as I say, is the starting point for a lot of the work that we do. So I've put this up, and I've got the brochure here to show you as well, because this was just a couple of days ago. So this was with 300, and these were our Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4 students. So though we had kind of like 14, 15-year-olds, and they do, we invite them onto campus to do a big questions day. So they come on campus and they have speakers, including, as I say, people like John, although John, I let you off this one. So you weren't here to help, but John Bryant and many others, as I say, in the room have been helping with these. And they have some talks and they do get very excited. And then I think to myself, okay, and then what? Because it can be what we call parachute style. As in, they parachute in, they're in the university for a day, we get them all excited, we tell them they're young scholars and they're going to, and then they're back in the classroom tomorrow, aren't they? And it's all exactly how it was when they left. And nothing has changed. So this new work that we're doing now is to integrate some of this into the curriculum, to really start to think about, well, where does it fit in the curriculum? Or is there just no hope? Is it just not in the curriculum? And if it could be in the curriculum, or even if it is in the curriculum, could it also be in teacher education? Could we be talking to teachers while they're in their training and helping them to think about this in a different way? Anyway, the joy of what we're doing at the minute is it is in the curriculum, but we've managed to ignore it. And now that we've noticed that it's there, we've started to have conversations with people like Amanda Spielman, who those some people might go boo hiss, but not many people here do, so that's fine. Amanda Spielman's Ofsted, So Head Bosted, she said recently we don't want the pub quiz curriculum. She thinks we've ended up with the pub quiz curriculum. And that's what they want to change. So it's a fantastic time to be working in education because so many of these challenges that I've looked at for a long time are starting to be talked about more generally. So some people who've heard me talk before will know that I almost always start with something a bit like this. But first of all, put your hand up if you went to school. Great, this is very relevant. All right, just one other question actually, I just wanted to know too. Put your hand up, I'm going to give you two things. You can see yourself as a scientist or you can see yourself as a polymath. Okay, who would see themselves as a scientist as opposed to a polymath? And who would see themselves as a polymath? No, but I want to know the difference. I'm offering it to you deliberately as a binary. I want to know who would sort of categorise themselves as a specialist and who would categorise themselves as, you know, drawing on their science, essentially a polymath. Because I do think historically, as we've talked about, isn't it, it is interesting that the way that, so we talk about people who we now label as scientists and who in the past probably did describe themselves as polymaths, wouldn't they? Some of the great scientists who were. So I always say, what's the one question you never had to ask yourself when you were at school? It's essentially, what is science? So why didn't you have to ask yourself that question? Well, as it says here, well, it says it's science in the timetable, so you know what you're going to. When you get to the door says science, the book says science, and just in case you were slightly unsure, the teacher introduces himself or herself as the science teacher. Now then, just to make sure that we've really soaked this up nicely, so that as a young person, you really do never need to ask the question, what is science? When you get to the exam, what does it say? It's the science exam. Exactly, so you open the paper and you already know what kinds of questions you will find in there. Now I've mentioned already that the curriculum doesn't say that you have to play that game. It doesn't say that when you open the exam paper for science, you will already find the very questions that we've already answered successfully in science. It doesn't say that, but that's become the agreement with teachers. And we know that because one of the exam boards was very brave one year, and they put a different kind of question in to test the part of the curriculum that says that children should be able to think about how science addresses questions. What happened? The teachers complained. Because the children couldn't answer the question. Because we've all got into this practice now of getting you as quickly as possible when you're in the classroom to the very questions that we know will be on your exam paper, and it's become this sort of invisible agreement with the exam boards that we will teach them what it says in the textbook, and when they get to the exam, you will ask them what was in the textbook. And if you don't, we'll change exam board. And we've now become very, very good at getting children through exams, and not very good at all at helping young people to think about what is the nature of science. So of course now I have to challenge you, don't I? What's the nature of science then? If you had a moment to introduce science to a young person, what would you like to say about the nature of science? And just to make it really hard, so you're doing my job, not the job that might have made it easier, I want you to explain it to a 9-year-old. All right? So you've got a 9-year-old. What's the nature of science? So think pair share, just for a moment. How would you introduce science? Okay. I've only sampled just a couple of people so far. I do notice some things coming through in some of the people's things that I've already heard. Does anybody want to? Sure.
Would somebody like to say what they thought as a pair? And then otherwise I've got some I can give you as examples. So what did somebody think? You have to be...
We decided it's good to take advantage of their pure, their natural.
Okay, that's great. Okay, so it's not just facts, it's thinking as well. Not just facts, but thinking. Anything else? Yes? Okay, universal. Mm-hmm. Are these things that you're saying to me at the moment, are they vastly different to any other subject that a child goes to? So now I'm going to make it more challenging and just give you another moment. So I'm 9 years old. I've got in my timetable history, geography, science, all of these other subjects. Why is one of them called science? What's special or different about science, which means it's not called geography? Or should it be? Should they all just be called scientia, knowledge? But essentially, that's the timetable they've got. They're going to these different branches of scholarship, aren't they? So we've gone with this way of characterizing different branches of scholarship. Well, you could say, of course, that science actually has physics, chemistry, and biology, and geology, and whatever in it. But for the moment, I'm only nine. So my timetable says science and history and geography and languages and so forth. So what's distinctive about science compared with the other ones? Right, another moment just to think, fair share. Okay, and I'm going to stop you already, just because I don't want you to get too good at doing my job, otherwise I won't have one. So, was that easier or harder? Just incidentally, was that easier or harder? It was harder. Yeah, it's interesting though, isn't it? So one of the things that we're doing in our work, so we call it the Epistemic Insight Initiative, and one of the things that we're doing is we're really trying to think about, well, what's it like for a student as they go from classroom to classroom? Why is it that they're coming back all the time with these same things about science? It's facts, it's proof, it's the right answer. And actually, when you look at what happens in their science classroom compared to what's happening in some of their other classrooms, you can see how there are things that we need to start to bring out much more about science, because compared to their other subjects, they are getting a very different picture of how science works and what science is. And we can say to them things like it's exciting and it's got uncertainty in it and all the rest of it, but compared in their experience to what's happening in some of their other subjects, that's just not the case. So how do we help them to have more what we call epistemic insight? How do we help them to really understand the nature of science? If we took these classroom boundaries down and we had to build our own understanding boundaries instead, so that we're trying to understand what makes science distinctive rather than just relying on classroom walls and textbooks. So as I say, that's what epistemic insight is. And that's why I find phrases like the ones that John and other people introduced me to, like sufficient truth, really exciting and really interesting. Because these are new ways of talking about science for young people. Is sufficient truth? How does that work? What's the difference between sufficient truth and what they think they've got at the moment? So I'm going to pass back to John to carry on. And I'm just going to say that, as you've heard, these are in the hallway on the table now. So these are invitations to our conference, which will be in the summer, and also to present papers if you'd like to. And then it's also got the website address on with more information. You can just whiz through these now to where you want to be. No, I just put these here in case it, for the end.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. You're right. We'll have them at the end.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm going to have to whiz through too because we're running out of time. Just two things I really want to bring out to, because I'm involved very much in science policy and other things like that, international science policy. This was a report produced a few years ago for the European European Parliament about the future of, as you can see at the top there, citizens in an interconnected and polycentric world. So, fascinating read, but it's getting on a bit. But in it, it says, knowledge is no longer concentrated in the hands of a few. It can be created and shared by ordinary citizens everywhere. challenging the very legitimacy of traditional sites of knowledge and information production such as universities and the media. Knowledge is no longer concentrated in the hands of the few, and that's what I'm going to talk about. And this was a slide I showed to the Competitiveness Council in the European Parliament 6 years ago, that science in the very nature of how it's done is changing as we move towards what we now call open science. What is it? It's about sharing with different disciplines, information, and not trying to hold it back and single author papers anymore. It's about actually making all your information open. And you've heard about it, for those in the universities will have heard about Plan S and all that stuff that's going on. This is all a result of initiatives we took about 5-6 years ago on taking this forward. I won't go into that, but this for just to frighten you, this is the slide I showed the European Parliament. I said this is the ecosystem that we are now living in. You can see there that's open data, scientific blogs, citizen science, open access. This is all part of the new ecosystem that's developed over the last half dozen years in how science is now done. For old lags like me, we can't think of this too easily. But it came about really by a report I chaired. In fact, it was 9 years ago, which produced this report called Riding the Wave, How Europe Can Gain from the Rising Tide of Scientific Data. And we set this up, and we said in there that we're now talking about global co-laboratories, about working together around the grand challenges. We've heard all about the environment and other grand challenges today. This is how we are going forward. And if we were still going to be in the European Union, then, in fact, under Horizon Europe, the next funding round, much of the funding will go into this sort of work. And this is what we said again about the public now being involved. This is about scientific democracy. Now, you might argue, well, they want to understand what we're talking about. Why not? Why not? Do we cloak our science behind words of mystery? And here again, the public has access and can make creative use of all the data that now is freely available. It sounds idyllic, doesn't it? It sounds idyllic. Well, let's see how we get on. Now, the big problem, though, is what happens if that information is misused? How do we know about its provenance? How do we know it's true? And into that, another initiative based at the University of Leiden has now got a worldwide legs, is GoFair, about data being findable, attributable, interoperable, and reusable. This was brought up by another report I did when I was chairing the European Research Area Board. Again, the commission at that time, Janusz Potocznik, talked about there being a new renaissance, a way of holistic thinking that involves everybody, involves bringing everybody together. And out of that has come the citizen science movement. This was an initiative at the University of Geneva about linking citizen cyber labs and the Sustainable Development Goals. This is going on, very many exciting projects around the environment and deforestation and things like that are now being done by citizen scientists. And you know there's the stuff about the weather, and that's one of the projects going on, but I thought I'd just put in the arts, and going back to the scholarship idea, there's a lot of work going on in citizen science around Shakespeare and other authors. And this is going to be my almost penultimate slide. Can you say that? This is what the work we're doing in CERN, in which I'm linked with. It's called Idea Squared, where we bring students, mainly MSc students, from different disciplines, from creative arts, from business, from sciences, engineering, and so on, and finance, and we give them grand challenges. And this is the environment. You may spot in there a rather odd artifact. That's the London double-decker bus. That's actually the meeting room. Got a good idea, you run in, ring the bell, and people join you. Okay, this is what's happening now. I was there, so was Anthony. We didn't see this going on at the time. But this is a very exciting idea, and it's now developing as a global network of what's called design factories, challenging the students to bring their ideas together. And if you really find yourself getting upset, there are various circles there. If you go into the circle, somebody will come and hug you and say it's okay. Okay. Come and visit it. It's really trying to get people to face up to these grand challenges and also challenging the very nature of what science is about. This is my last but one slide, and this goes back to the sort of poetic thing. This is the theologian Walter Brueggemann. It's precisely the daring work of fiction to probe beyond the settled truth and to walk on the edge of alternatives not yet available to us. It is this proof behind our settlements that makes newness possible. And I come back to one of my quotes from, which is started from Isaiah, and Jesus used it in the parable of the sower, and then Paul right at the end of Acts. This is why I speak to them in parables. Though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. And then the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled. You will be ever hearing, but never understanding. You will be ever seeing, but never perceiving. I hope we won't just be people of knowledge, of facts, that we'll be perceivers, and that we will be people who really do understand. Thank you.